Welcome back to Match Volume. We're your hosts, Hala Oscar
and Sadie Olson. As always, let's get into our obsessions. Hala, what are you obsessed with this week?
So I kind of go through YouTube phases, and this phase is all about thrift flips. There are entire channels dedicated to taking old clothes and revamping them for some new fashion. It's dressing great on a budget.
I also have a YouTube obsession this week, but mine is with tiny house videos. There's a channel called Living Big in a Tiny House, and I've been watching them so frequently because I just love to see how people use a tiny space to create a very cool house. This week's topic is music. I interviewed the founder of Vans Warped Tour and USC music professor Kevin Lyman.
And to get another perspective on the music industry, student reporter Kate Young interviewed podcaster and USC professor Nate Sloan.
Hello, my name is Kevin Lyman. I'm an associate professor here at USC in the Thornton School of Music.
Okay, what do you teach in Thornton?
I'm teaching music industry classes, kind of focusing on branding, marketing, some production. My background was in festival producing, but I'm also teaching a class that I'm really, I think is very poignant. We're producing a project called the 320 Project. It's a mental health festival with Talinda Bennington, Chester Bennington's wife from Linkin Park. So
cool.
It's a pretty important, poignant project. Even though
right.
we started it six months ago, it kind of continues my worked in the music business for 38 years, and I'm still producing events, so
right.
I'm not completely retired from that.
Yeah.
But it was always my philosophy was always music, education, and philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've taken a little bit of a step back where music will always be part of it, but now the education and philanthropy part are so important to me.
Right. What is the best part about teaching music here?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, you have this brain, and I think a lot of the part for me was to go into education. I wasn't really looking for it. I always felt that we were teaching people out on the road how to tour, how to brand themselves mm-hmm. and be part of culture, crew people to work. But when this opportunity came up, because I really wasn't searching for it, it was through a couple of adjuncts who actually I interned. A couple of them had actually gone to USC. They recruited me to come over here about a year and a half ago, and timing was great. And I think it's one of those things where I've always challenged the norms of the music business. I've remained independent for 38 years. That was a big part of it for me. So I think it's kind of download as much of your brain as possible and help people formulate their own path,
mm-hmm.
but throwing it out in a slightly different way. I think my classes are a little different than the norm. We do branding classes and non-traditional. It's a lot about branding yourself and
yeah.
who you are, wherever you are in life.
Right.
Creating, because we are all viewed as a brand now.
Right, right. What are you currently working on outside of being a professor?
Oh my gosh, I just, I'm working on the 320 Project,
mm-hmm.
which will be held on May 9th. At LA Live.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to get a lot of artists and speakers, and it's going to be a free community event. We're going to have about 40 nonprofits that focus on mental health and awareness, a cross-section of LA, because I think we have the resources here. Sometimes you can't find them.
Mm-hmm.
That'll tie into a benefit show. We're also going to hold an event at Bovard on March 9th. So that'll be an event that will kick off the whole 320 and I'm working on Recovery Fest with Macklemore right now.
Oh, very cool.
And I just finished up an event this past weekend kind of for the culture of gaming. You know, we talk about gaming being so big right now.
Yeah.
But kind of creating an event, maybe not for the 10% hardest core gamers, but for the other 90% of the people who like to game.
Yeah.
And that's called Player Omega. And we just did it in Pomona, and it'll be doing a 10-city tour this summer.
Very cool. How did you end up in the music industry?
Well, it was my accidental fall into the music industry started when I was in college.
Yeah.
I was a student at Cal Poly Pomona,
mm-hmm.
and I was on the ski team, which was a club sport, which is always underfunded.
Yeah.
And funny, we used to be great friends with everyone at USC when I was in school. We used to travel together to events.
That's fun.
we weren't flying to ski races. We would all bus together and share buses. But one of the things I started doing was I fell in love with music at that point in college. I was a little lost in college. I was there, but I didn't really know what I, like so many people, we're trying to figure out who we are and what we're about. And I was walking through campus one day and heard some music, and they were doing a noontime concert. And I just fell in love with music and started. Had a van, one of those old Woody vans that you know you see in those old movies, Jeff Spicoli's van.
Wow, yeah.
And everyone would pile in my van, and we would go to the Sunset Strip to watch bands. That was the kind of the new wave punk era.
Yeah.
And I started meeting a lot of bands, and then I decided, well, maybe I can bring these bands, and do shows out. And we'd rent a fraternity house backyard, and do shows and. And then I graduated from college, and I still wasn't sure what I was going to do. And I went to Hawaii and ran a weight loss camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back, and someone said, hey, all that experience you had, there's a club in Long Beach. Would you like, maybe they need a stage manager.
Wow.
You're pretty good at this. So I kind of fell into that, but immediately knew that I never wanted to become that guy. Or, you know, I always call it that guy because we go to concerts and we're so happy to be with all our friends.
Yeah.
And music was such in my heart that, but there's always someone bumming your night out.
Yeah.
Like the security guard, the box office person, someone that's been there way too long.
Yeah.
So, you know, the minute I started working in those clubs was the minute I was trying to think of how I was going to do this for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And just kind of worked my way up. And it was a really exciting time in music in Los Angeles. We were working with all the bands no one else wanted to work with. When there was like the Bon Jovis or the Journeys and when that kind of stuff. We were working with, you know, the Black Flags and the Dead Kennedys and then the Ramones and these kind of bands. And those bands turned into the Red Hot Chili Peppers and the Jane's Addictions and those kind of, you know, that music, Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
And then I went out as the first stage manager of Lollapalooza in 1991 when it was a touring festival.
Yeah.
And then I was working 320 shows a year. I was building quite a production company around town and a good reputation by just treating people right. And that's what I always say. A lot of this business is just treating people right. And I had that opportunity. And then in 1995, my daughter, we were having our first child then. I was thinking about that time to get that real job. As some of your parents, if you go into the creative spaces, sometimes will be asking you, is that a real job?
Yeah,
it's funny you explain that, and especially in classes, and you see everyone's heads kind of go nod up and down.
Right.
And I was actually at that point, you know, should I go get something that you get a paycheck every 2 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
My first paycheck is at USC. I get one once a month now. It's pretty exciting. It was the first time I've ever had a consistent paycheck in my life at 58 years old. I was going to go do that, but there was a merging going on in Southern California of skateboarding culture and music. We were doing a lot of stuff for charity, and that's always been something in my life. We'd always throw a lot of benefit shows. We did the first Rock the Vote show, the Root Rock for Choice shows. I was involved in all those in L.A. We were always doing something. And then we would do shows up in the snow, Board Aid. This is when the AIDS crisis was coming to the forefront, and we started doing shows to raise money for AIDS. We would blend snowboarding and skateboarding and bands and put it on the side of a mountain. And then I was doing boarding for breast cancer, where we were doing for breast cancer research. And I was sitting in the snow one day and I heard someone say, hey, there's going to be this X Games coming. And I think that's something I always tell all my students. You know, just absorb the environment around you. We can all become very narrow focused, but just listen. And I heard someone say the X Games, and I listened a little more. And I go, you know what? This whole lifestyle we've been leading in Southern California is going to start spreading out. You know, maybe the skateboarding was big in certain little niches in Florida and surfing, but really, if they were talking about it's going to be on television, the media was going to be much bigger. So I said, well, maybe I can do this for one last summer and load up some of my friends and bring a skateboard ramp and go run a festival the way I wanted to. And in 1995, I really kind of jammed it out there, started the Warped Tour in 95. That became the Vans Warped Tour. I was learning how to blend corporate sponsorships at that point, like understanding that we were all supporting these brands. Maybe I could go get some of their money to help us with help us with what we loved. And I've been able to navigate that now for many, many years. You know, the Warped Tour just wrapped up its 25th and final year. A lot of people ask me why it ended, and I said, you know, I'd done everything I possibly can with that project. I wasn't getting as much personal gratification, and some people think it was financial. It wasn't. It was more myself, how to push myself and keep myself interested. And wrapping that up has opened up many, many opportunities right now. The teaching is fantastic, and I really enjoy being here. I think coming to this campus with this, the timing maybe you find yourself in the right place at the right time. And I think some of the stuff I do is important. And I'm really enjoying getting to know the students here on campus.
Very cool. Yeah, I think what's interesting about your story is, like, most people when they're in college, they fall in love with, like, playing music, whereas you were, like, you fell in love with the production and the behind the scenes and the organization, which I think is really fascinating.
Oh, I am the worst. I've tried to learn how to play guitar. Yeah. I am like a 2-year-old. Probably yeah. No, 2-year-olds are much better than me at playing instruments. And skateboarding, yeah. I'm a good skier. I was a good skier to allow myself, but skateboarding, I just never could get excellent at.
Yeah.
So, but all these skateboarders and musicians lived in my house, and we had to pay the rent somehow. But I knew how to talk on the phone.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd drag him off the couch and make him come into Hollywood and unload a few vans or trucks to help pay the rent each month.
Right.
So I was kind of like this workforce I had of people that were crashing at my house that if you're going to still live here, you're going to come work and I'm going to keep your, you know, going to help pay the rent.
Yeah.
So I had this little mini workforce going on. And so many of those people have gone on to do wonderful things in the music space. They fell in love with it just like I did and did wonderful things.
Very cool. So, yeah, you talk about your blend of education, philanthropy, and music. How do you blend those things together in your events?
Well, I always tell people that, you know, you're starting to do charity is easy when you have nothing sometimes. If it just, you bake it into all your business plans.
Yes.
So all my business plans have always had some sort of philanthropic bent. Mm-hmm. You know, it can simply, like with Warped, we started donating a quarter a ticket. Mm-hmm. From the beginning, when we were making no money, but we still carved out a quarter and gave it to charity. It's easy. I have a golf tournament coming up here in January that we bring all these friends together, but we make it accessible to people. A lot of golf tournaments you might play in are very expensive to be in, but we make this accessible for people that can come and maybe be part of it once. Mm-hmm. We do bowling tournaments on tour. We'd always have a bowling tournament. We still do that bowling event on a day off. And then that kind of turned into our give back day. We did that around... Hurricane Katrina, and we went down to New Orleans afterwards, and Rita, and took a day off after the tour, or in the middle of the tour the next year, to give back. And that went on for all the way through the tour, where we did Sandy relief, flood relief in Nashville. We did some Monterey Bay cleanup. So wherever we were on tour that we actually had one of our few days off, we took one of those to kind of give back. And that's what I'm trying to instill in everyone, that, you know, being grandiose in charity is one thing, but just baking it into your life each day you possibly can, it becomes just a natural thing. You always kind of think along those lines.
Yeah, so what are some of the philanthropic causes that are closest to your heart, would you say?
Well, we've worked with over 90 nonprofits. I have my own foundation, Unite the United, which we do raise money and then disperse it out to others. But a lot of it focused on teens and youth, and because that's kind of the world I was working in. To Write Love on Our Arms became a national nonprofit by starting in a parking lot of Warped Tour, sitting there in Florida, and then became a national nonprofit. You know, we worked with Keep Abreast, which was the I Love Boobies campaign. Mm-hmm. We did that. We still throw events for them. Mm-hmm. Brubies, which is their craft beer festival do each year. We put that on. We produce that. Then it became, you know, Music Cares. I was on the board of Music Cares for 10 years. TJ Martell, I was involved with them, and I still am. And then it starts spinning in a lot, you know, your life doesn't go through, if you put yourself out there after all this time, there's going to be some controversies. And there was some stuff in my life that I was learning how to navigate. And, you know, I think understanding, you know, I was in the middle of a storm of social media, like so many of you go through, which was mind boggling to me that, you know, I was trying to navigate it the best I could. And, you know, it was nothing directly related to me, but I got involved, you know, because working through that. But it opened up a window of a voice for the innocent about sexual abuse and bringing them in and helping them become the national forefront, which they're now a national nonprofit. But I wasn't trained in any of this. That's what people don't realize. I was self-taught in all this. So I was living it in real time sometimes. And sometimes in real time, I learned very much that you can't really debate, negotiate, and it's rarely can you educate with social media. And I got caught up. I thought everyone deserved an answer. I thought everything, where sometimes you just have to shut it down for a little bit, figure out and move and how to handle it. And I think I was living, you know, people don't realize sometimes even I was out on the road. It was 2 months and I'm living on a bus. I'm trying to run shows all day long. I was trying to navigate some problems with maybe an artist that wasn't on my tour even at that point. But I think that was a little bit of the burden of taking on responsibility for a whole culture of music at times. I did that, but I learned. But A Voice for the Innocent, I mean, Hope for the Day. Johnny from Hope for the Day was just on campus the other day, which I think the timing was very important right now. We're now working with the Given Hour, and just so many different things. And Rise Above Disorder, there's one. And now there's a new organization that I've been talking to, and they're going to be involved in the 320, and they're called Backline. And they're going to provide mental health services for anyone who might be in the entertainment business who finds themselves away from home and alone and needs a resource. So I think, you know, it can become overwhelming sometimes on a personal level. You got to take care of yourself at times.
Right, yeah.
And I'm learning that you can't, if you can't save yourself, you can't save, you know, the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realize you can't save the world, that you can maybe help your community more.
Yeah.
Because right now we are suffering a giant collective anxiety in society that can overwhelm anyone.
For sure. So is it challenging? So like the music industry can be seen as kind of like artists are temperamental, like it's kind of just like a challenging industry to be a part of in the first place. So is it hard to bring in like charitable causes to an industry like that?
I think we're waking up.
Yeah.
I think we're waking up. You know, and it's always been part of me. And I've been in the business 38 years, and I've been pushing it. But more recently, in the last couple of years, I've seen more people paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
That we have to take responsibility. You know, artists can be temperamental, but I think a lot of time that temperamental is part of a whole greater being. And that along comes with that is insecurity at sometimes. And how do we help that? You know, I'm a very big advocate for our industry that we, you know, that we have to have independent sources that can help us if, you know, these giant contracts that people are signing to go on these massive tours, you know, and we've lost Tom Petty, we've lost Prince, Michael Jackson, these kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
They were all under a huge amount of personal pressure where I don't know if there was anyone that could tell them to stop. I've been an advocate that people who insure music tours should have a independent checkup of those artists at any time. Drop in and make sure that artist is in physical as well as mental ability to carry on, because we you know, that term, the show must go on. We all hear it. So whenever it's the long tail of that singer goes all the way to the crew, the bus drivers, everyone, that we all push through. You know, I was guilty of that. I've had a lot of injuries on the road. I'm pretty physical about my job, and you know, and you start self-medicating in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, I could have slipped into addiction probably pretty easily if I wasn't so aware, self-aware that I was probably going down a dark path at one point. But now, you know, who's going to tell someone? Does the manager want to tell someone you need to come off the road? He loses his commission.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to go explain to these giant promoters that, hey, we need to come off the road. My singer's not well enough to be out here. Does anyone, you know, we need independent people that can walk in and say, you are not fit to be on the road right now.
Mm-hmm.
Shut it down. Because I don't think we would have lost some of the people we have if we could do that.
Very true. So what are some of the other outside of the Vans Warped Tour, what are some other events that you've been a part of creating?
Well, I had the Mayhem Rockstar Mayhem Festival, which is heavy metal based. I had the Taste of Chaos, which during that period of time around 2005, when that whole emo thing, I go, maybe a Warped Tour indoors during the wintertime. And that first year we had the Used and My Chemical Romance, which is everyone's excited that they've just had this new reunion coming back. My Chemical Romance, we toured the world with that. We did about 20 countries with that. I've worked on the Sprite Liquid Mix with Jay-Z. I've done Country Throwdown. I had Willie Nelson. That was my dream to work with him at some point.
That's cool, yeah.
And I had that out. And it was early in country, when country was transitioning to artists. And the claim to fame from that tour was Florida Georgia Line hauled my barbecue for $500 a show. But we had Eric Church and Brantley Gilbert. I was watching the transition from CD selling, cowboy hat wearing kind of vibe to this more rock country kind of thing. And that younger people were discovering music the same way punk or pop kids were listening to things on, at that point, iPods on shuffle. And they might blend in a little country and little things. And so I got to work in that world. I was able to build the campgrounds for Paul Tolette at Coachella, because I used to run all the shows for Golden Voice. That was the production company that I had. And he needed some help building out his campgrounds because I always told him that if you never can develop those campgrounds, Coachella couldn't become what it was because no one would be able to afford to stay out there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So I went in there, and that was a pretty big project. You know, I've done a lot of different things. I did the World Surf League this year for Kelly Slater up at the Surf Ranch. Mm-hmm. Brought a bunch of students. It's been really cool because I have students that have been able to work on so many things. And I think that's important, real life experience. So we had students this weekend working at Player Omega. We've had them out at the World Surf League. They worked at the Ohana Festival. Some of them are walking across the street this weekend to work over at Adult Swim.
Okay.
So it's really important to blend real life experiences with your education.
For sure.
And I'm hoping to open those doors for more students because, you know, I'm getting great reports because they bring them in and they're going, they work hard, they listen, and they have a good attitude. And really, that's kind of the story, how to make it through life.
Yeah, for sure. So what's next for you? Where do you see yourself going next?
Oh, my gosh. You know, this is going to be very interesting. Where am I going next? I'm going to teach a class right now, but it's weird because I've never had any really long term plans, and being 58 now, you know, some of the physical side of what I love to do is getting harder.
Yeah.
So you know, I'm never going to sit in an office. I don't like sitting in an office. I like to be up and around. So I'm trying to take care of myself a little more. I think this is going to be the first summer where I'm actually going to be able to take my wife on a long-term vacation to some of those spots. Maybe I pass through in a tour bus at times.
Yeah. Where are you going?
You know, we were talking the other day. We're going to go head out, you know, all the national parks. We're going to go up into Canada.
Awesome.
And Canadian Rockies. It'll be nice to be able to do that because we never have been able to. And you know, being in a relationship in this business is not easy.
Mm-hmm.
It's never easy in relationships, but I think this business can be even more trying. So I needed to, we're kind of reintroducing ourselves to each other in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Glen Ivy Hot Springs yesterday. That was kind of a nice, something different that we would have known.
It's
down in Corona, east of here. It was kind of like for me, and I left my phone in the car for 7 hours.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's, I love doing that.
So, I'm going to dig in. And I, as I've told Mike Garcia, who runs our department, I'll be at USC as long as I feel like I'm relevant.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to stay. I'll stay active in the business. But the minute that I don't think I'm keeping the students up to date or something that can move forward because our business moves so fast, then it'll be time for me to move on.
For sure. Well, thanks for coming in, Kevin.
Well, thank you for having me, Sadie. Appreciate it.
I'm Nate Sloan. I'm a assistant professor of musicology at the University of Southern California, Thornton School of Music.
And why did you start your podcast?
We started our podcast to take pop music and use it as like a Trojan horse. Pop music was the spoonful of sugar that would help the music theory medicine go down. If the goal of the podcast was in some respects to give people the tools to create basically musical literacy, then pop music was the ideal vehicle to do that because people wouldn't be so suspicious of trying to learn something about how music works if it was in the form of a bubbly, infectious, catchy pop song that they already knew.
Obviously, you're also a professor, so you're in a unique position to be able to quite literally craft a syllabus about how and what you want to teach.
Yeah.
So how has that relationship kind of informed how you approach the podcast?
The relationship between my pedagogy and the podcast is, I think, really due to the unique and specific nature of my position at the Thornton School of Music is one of remarkable overlap. And I say that because I'm teaching at one of the few institutions that has a dedicated pop music program. That's pretty exceptional and a pretty lucky place for a pop podcaster to land. Doing the podcast keeps me incredibly current on what's happening in the sound and the contemporary music industry. And then inversely, the art of lecturing and presenting sometimes esoteric information in a very clear way really filters beautifully into the world of podcasting.
In our last conversation, you talked a little bit too about how you didn't used to like pop music, and
yeah.
part of the process of the podcast was kind of working your way out through that. Can you talk a little bit about that and how your attitude to pop music has changed?
When we started the show, it was predicated on the notion of pop being a means to an end. We wanted to essentially trick people into learning music theory. Let's use something that appears very innocuous and familiar and unthreatening. And then something unexpected happened, which was that this genre that we maybe deigned to talk about became an end unto itself. The more I was able to enjoy pop in a way was probably proportional to how frivolous I thought it was before. So finding meaning in like what previously I would have just rejected out of hand, acts like One Direction, Justin Bieber, Taylor Swift. The more I looked directly into the eyes of those musicians, the more I was like, oh, wait, maybe my views of pop's lack of integrity are not actually motivated by the music or the artists themselves, but rather by my own preconceptions. And all of a sudden, then pop has become a conduit for like being a more accepting person of who you are and who others are, and maybe like a radical exercise in empathy.
I think that's pretty profound, actually. And I wanted to backtrack a little because some of the acts that you mentioned as, you know, the music that you didn't take seriously,
yeah.
I couldn't help but notice that it's the kind of music that is very often most appealing to teen girls.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to know, like, how much have you thought about kind of that relationship between what girls love and what gets ridiculed?
It's something I've thought about a lot. When we did our episode about Harry Styles and One Direction in general, I think are really good ciphers for what you're describing. That was an opportunity to think about not only the phenomenon of teen girl fandom in the contemporary sense, but in the historical sense too. There's a really interesting analog between One Direction and the Beatles. When you start to listen to individual teen girls and what they get out of this music, then the situation really changes, I think. And whether it's watching interviews with British teenagers from the 1960s or YouTube videos by contemporary Harry Styles fans, when you hear an individual person talking about what the music means to them, it really changes your perspective, and I think it allows you to take their fandom much more seriously. Like, anyone would be wise to pay attention to what teen girls are listening to, because they are often ahead of the curve in terms of what is becoming the next sort of mainstream pop phenomenon. That's absolutely true of the Beatles, who were, I find it easy to imagine a sort of similar revisionist history when it comes to One Direction and Harry Styles, that future generations of music historians will be like, oh, actually, we kind of missed the boat on this.
So I also wanted to talk a little bit about like just general cultural sensitivity issues. I mean, obviously, both of you are white men, and
yeah.
not all of the music that you cover is produced by white men. And I have observed that you have taken care to involve guests and speakers who can speak to experiences that you can't. Like, was that always a conscious decision? How did you come around to recognizing kind of the experiences that you couldn't speak to?
As we're recording this in September 2019, I've read a lot of news pieces that are starting to push back against I guess what's being called cancel culture. And I suppose I agree with some of that, but I will say that I think certain aspects of cancel culture have been incredibly valuable for our show. Doing a show like this today can be really nerve-wracking, in the sense that you might start to second guess everything you say or write, because it might be perceived as problematic. So, and I know that's, a lot of people have a lot of issue with that, but I have to say that I don't. I appreciate and in some ways treasure having to think about every single thing I say. And that's because we've gotten so many emails and tweets over the years that have been really impassioned by people saying like, hey, when you said this thing, or when you didn't include this, or when you misrepresented this, like, this is how it made me feel. And this is why I think that was really injurious. And when it's like that, when it's a personal entreaty from someone who's just like trying to tell you, like, I think you need to do better for these reasons, it's really hard to have any response but like, what, thank you, and we'll try and do better. So by taking our listeners seriously, I think that's the reason we've become much better about bringing diverse voices to the show, taking care to do more research when we're talking about musical styles that are sort of outside of our wheelhouse.
And that's it for this episode of Match Volume.
Follow us on Instagram at Match Volume and tune in every other Friday for new episodes. A special thanks to Kate Young for contributing to this episode. For Annenberg Media, I'm Hala Oscar.
And I'm Sadie Olson. See you next time.